This is Malcolm Duck, and you're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Radio Golf Show. I think most of us can agree that Scotland's gift to the world is golf. However, it's one of many Scotland's gifts to the world. And today we're going to throw in another one, one that's, as far as I know, roughly 800 years older than the game loved by us and by people all over the planet, and that's whiskey. To educate us about the deep historical connection between the two, we are joined by the dram caddy, Hamish Malcolm. Hamish, thank you for coming on the show. Welcome to the radio.
Thank you, Frank. Pleasure to be on with you, sir.
We're going to have a good time. Let's start. Okay, the dram caddy. What number one, what's a dram?
So a dram is a Scottish term for a short drink, as in not a pint of any spirit, but particularly a nip of whiskey, a measure of whiskey, we'll say.
So it's not a exactly measured amount. It's just like a finger or whatever you would call it or something like that?
It's a good point, Frank. If you're on licensed premises in Scotland, it definitely needs to be measured. When not on licensed premises, sometimes not measured quite so closely, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the pubs in Scotland and England, they have the bottles upside down with the measuring thing. You can tip the bartender as much as you want. That's the way. That's their way they're going. You have come up with a fascinating, and I don't know even if it's a marketing concept, but just a business model. We all know that whiskey and golf have a special connection, and that we have distilleries hooking up with golf clubs. I think there was just some big stories about King's Barn, where they released some limited golf-related products. But instead of tourists, I guess, or even locals, going to play a round of golf and then being carted off to a distillery for a tour, you bring the whiskey to the golf club, I guess, most of the time, or wherever they want it brought to, correct?
Yeah, that's right, Frank. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how that would work? I mean, if somebody hires the dram caddy, and we'll talk about your caddying days for sure, what's going on there. But let's say a group of eight guys, two foursomes, they play and they call you up, hey, after the round, I want you to come by the club and do your thing for us. What does that look like?
Yeah, so I'm based just outside of Inverness, Frank, in an area called Culloden. So I'm literally 5 minutes from Castle Stewart. I'm about 20 minutes from Nairn, under an hour from Lossiemouth, Murray Golf Club, and going north away, about an hour up to Dornoch. So I'm a sole trader, a one-man band, and I'm just trying to be as flexible as I can. I'll come to the golfer. So most cases, it's after the round of golf, before the evening meal. And as I say, totally flexible. I have a couple of other venues as well, which are not golf clubs, but you know, can be good to have drinks in. So as opposed to having to go to, say, a distillery, you've got to be there for a certain time. I'm more flexible with time, so they can book me. I'll check out their itinerary. When are they in the Highlands? Where are they at? Where's most convenient? And I'm happy to go to them and, you know, within reason, be as flexible as I can with time. I probably don't want to be up in Dornoch past midnight, still with little glasses to rinse out and then drive home. But I don't have conventional opening hours like a distillery. You might be closed by 6 p.m., etc. So that's how I take my bookings and fulfill them.
Yeah, and as opposed to a wine tasting, at a whiskey tasting, you don't spit, do you?
I've never seen it done. Occasionally, some of the whiskies might be too strong or of a certain nature, especially peated. So occasionally people can say, this one isn't for me. I'll simply offer, they can pass that to their friend sitting next to them. And especially for the North American visitors, Frank, who like the concept of a mulligan, if it's just not to somebody's taste, I usually have a little reserve bottle on hand, and I'll offer the person a mulligan just to make sure they're not left out.
There you go. That sounds beautiful. But let's talk about maybe the cultural and social significance that whiskey and golf have in common. I think number one, it's the tradition and the craftsmanship and the time you put into it. More than anything, I believe it has to do with camaraderie, because I would imagine your prime operating spot would be the 19th hole.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And I guess, and I say as a golf fan and a golf caddy, sometimes caddying for the groups who come and do a tasting, but sometimes not. I suppose I'm there to receive them in the 19th hole. I kind of sometimes say we're going to talk about the dramas on the golf course and then the dramas in the glass. So, some people will come off the course have had a great day, some people not so much. And it's doing a nice little tasting, maybe of five whiskies, and taking them a little tour of virtual tour of Scotland. Definitely talking about the whiskies and enjoying them for what they are, Frank. And it's not to turn into some really serious, heavy kind of history lesson, but hopefully to bring the whiskies to life. There'll be some old distilleries, some new ones, and I think it really fits in with the golf well because a lot of visitors will come over to play really old courses. I mean, it's like Roy Dornoch or Nairn, equally some newer courses like okay Castle Stewart from 2009, Old Petty the brand new course. So it is almost I like that concept of the mix of the old and the new, and I think you can weave quite a narrative through the whisky and the golf with both of those concepts, you know.
I think that's what, and it's a good point you bring up. I think on your website, which is dramcaddy.com, you describe yourself as a Sherpa when it comes to whiskey tea. I found that great. I mean, everybody knows what a Sherpa is, that will see lugs people up Mount Everest, but so you take, and we talked about this before we started recording. If I play my favorite golf course and then drink my favorite whiskey afterwards, without really any connection, whatever my favorite whiskey may be and whatever my favorite golf course may be, without any real connection between the two, so one just becomes an accompaniment to the other, and that can make a great day or a great night. But what I think you are doing, the way I understand it, is that you really pair things, and like people pair wine with food. We on this program, we've paired champagne with cigars, and you seem to pair whiskey with golf. And our dear friend Mike Herklotz, who has a very cool cigar brand, Ferry Otego, for the last 4 or 5 years, big cigar guy, very clever guy. He said something to the effect that pairing means that you're taking two things that are perfectly consumable alone, and you're putting them together in such a way that it creates an experience that is better than the two of them were separately. And for that, you need an awareness of both things. Your awareness of whiskey and your awareness of golf. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they do go together well. Plus, an authentic story. Again, I kind of, I suppose I retired. I don't know if this is retirement or not. I'm in just now, Frank, but I kind of left the finance world 2 years ago, where I'd been in 38 years. And a lot of that time, I was maybe working for bigger corporates where you've got to kind of play the party line, shall we say. So, and I take great delight in not playing any party line. I can give my own opinion on brands, on meaning, and I can just have develop my own script. It's authentic stories, some personal anecdotes, some reflections. And yeah, the feedback from everybody I've done tastings for has been really good, and it's really different from just a night in the pub or just ordering ordering a drink at the clubhouse as a transaction. We're really getting into the stories behind it and the links between golf, the ups and downs on the golf course, and some of the ups and downs of the whisky world in Scotland, which have been turbulent over the centuries. I do appreciate a lot of my clients come from North America, and they have a little thing over there called Disneyland. Scotland is not Disneyland. There's been highs, there's been lows, there's been intrigue, there's been skullduggery, there's been all sorts. So I'm here to be positive on all things golf and whiskey, but you can't sanitize some of the background, some of the backstory, the history. And I like to bring it to life in an upbeat fashion. But we go a deep dive. We're not scripted to just promote It's Always Sunny in Scotland. That's not true either, okay?
Yeah, well, no, that I can say that. And I imagine that your awareness of the game of golf is older than your awareness of whiskey.
True,
Can you
yes.
talk us a little bit about your through your personal history with the game from the first time you swung a club to becoming a caddy?
So I mean, I got into golf probably like a lot of young guys in kind of Scotland, kind of 10, 12 years old, that kind of thing. I think the first time I actually made it to a golf club would have been 1981. What used to be the municipal course in Inverness is now the King's on the outskirts of Inverness, which is two holes that are the same as that original 18. I think I was just always into a lot of sports, Frank. So sometimes football would take the front runner for a couple of years, but golf always pulled me back. Obviously, young kids growing up, that can put a strain in your available time for dodging off for 4 or 5 hours. Certainly, in my finance career, a lot of that was centered around hospitality, playing little corporate events, that kind of thing. Although I lived away from the Highlands for most of the 90s, most of my golfing time has been spent in the Highlands, playing at different courses in Nairn, Inverness, up to Dornoch. The handicap I got now is actually the lowest handicap I've ever had. So I've somehow managed to claw myself down to 12.2. I don't think I'm going to be taking any money off anybody playing to that handicap this year, Frank. So we'll see if normality kicks in and I might sit somewhere in the mid-teens again.
Yeah,
But
I'll
yeah,
tell you
drop.
what. I tell you what. Scottish handicaps travel much better than German handicaps. So,
Okay.
if you make it down to Germany, I think you'll make some money. Sorry to interrupt. How did she end up becoming a caddy?
So, as I say, I kind of took my leave of my finance career in 2024. And I guess, I mean, again, there's a really good, well-run professional caddy program at Castle Stewart, and I knew a lot of guys who were in that. So I guess coming into that summer of 2024, yeah, it felt an easy decision to make to just lean into that and join the kind of ranks there of that first season. And I suppose going back to my Sherpa kind of strap line, Frank, again, when you're in a serious career like finance, it's maybe not very cool to admit, here's the mistakes I've made. When I'm doing the golfing, caddying, I'm very open with clients or golfers about all the tremendously bad positions I've been in golf courses, certainly Castle Stewart. So whatever bunker they want to look at, whatever bit of gorse, I've probably been there. So I say, look, here's the mistakes I made, folks. So don't go over there, let's go over here. And equally, on the whiskey side, absolutely over the years, I've overpaid for some whiskey. I've gone on some distillery tours weren't worth the money. And I've followed some brands which didn't turn out to be as authentic as I thought. So the Sherpa kind of route is I've been there, I've made the mistakes, I've shrugged myself off, I laugh about them. I'm just a bit openly imparting some of those mistakes so that people can stay in the straight and narrow in the golf course and enjoy the best whiskies.
There you go. Well, I mean, obviously people can enjoy a wee dram before a round, during a round, or after the round. What do you see any people? I mean, in Germany, and I guess all over the world, the flask has pretty much become a must-have for any golf bag of a golfer over the age of 18, I guess. I don't know. Is that the same in Scotland?
Yeah, I would say yeah, it's pretty common. I'm probably going into my first year of caddying. I thought I'd take a flask with me, but that's not really permitted for the caddies to do that. So that wouldn't be what I could do. I guess I mean, again, the clubs are probably more attuned now to obviously making all refreshments available to the golfer either before the kickoff. Most have now got some sort of halfway house, and again, in terms of the three main courses, where I'm at over the summer, Dornoch, Nairn with the Bothy, and the halfway house at Castle Stewart, I think that's become more of a thing now. So the visiting golfer can refresh themselves and take fresh supplies out for the second nine, shall we say. And absolutely the 19th hole itself, yeah, there's all sorts of refreshments for them there as well, But yeah, certainly the hip flask of unknown origins and unknown what's in there is certainly a regular thing that is seen on the courses in Scotland.
It is pretty cool. And let's just make one thing perfectly clear. I mean, these and let's call them tastings or whatever it is that you organize for them. It's not about catching a buzz. It's about intertwining the enjoyment of golf with the appreciation of the whiskey.
It's about keeping the golf chat going through the whole day, and absolutely, Frank, I would say there's been some times I've come off the 18th hole, and I don't want to think about golf the next time I'm picking up the bag, okay? Because it's been one of those days.
Right.
But as opposed to totally parking the golf, and we're going to the pub, or we're going to a distillery, great experience though that is. We're still talking the golf while we're having the whiskies. And invariably, as part of a group, there's always the day's dramas get thrown up. Who had a great outward nine? Who won the money? Who won the bet? So it kind of keeps that banter, as we call it, going all the way through. Which, of course, if you had the good day in the course, Frank, is a wonderful thing,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always you have more fun when you play good than when you play bad, of course. To these events, you said you bring five different kinds of whiskey.
My standard offering's five. On occasion, maybe people aren't really, I say big drinkers or just a more brief version of it. So on a couple of occasions, I've done a three dram lineup. I call it the live version, but with less money, not more money. But as standard, it's five whiskies. Always give them lots of water to try with it as well. So we are responsible drinking. Nothing's rushed. Usually last between I say technically round about either side of an hour. If there's an evening meal to go to, clearly the guests have to be there sitting down at their table. Sometimes it's after the meal. Depending on the interaction and the vibe of the group, Frank, I've seen me there still 2.5 hours later, just talking golf, whiskey, history, shenanigans.
The drives get longer and the putts get better and that kind of
Completely.
thing. Would you be selecting whiskies that somebody from the States or from continental Europe has never heard of, or would they also include things, the brands that we're familiar with?
So, certainly when I set out putting the whiskies together, Frank, and to be fair, probably, I don't know, 90% of my clientele is from North America. So it seemed to me there was no point whatsoever doing whiskies that can buy in travel retail or buy back home. So big, huge brands like Diageo, Macallan have become successful by great distribution, and the whiskies are everywhere. So I kind of go for what I call the dram less travelled. So you'd certainly have some distilleries like Tomaten, for example, which I think is very well supported over in Germany. Certainly playing at Castle Stewart, there's a lot of interconnection between Tomaten and Castle Stewart and Cabot. So I'd normally have a Tomaten in there. But I just like to mix it up. So I've had some very, I think, enthusiastic people about Scotch whiskey have come to a lineup and said, "We've never heard of any of these whiskies before. But now we've heard of them, we love them." And while I don't sell bottles of whiskey, Frank, that's not my shtick, I can source bottles for people and also arrange to get them shipped back home. I think the furthest I've had a bottle shipped so far is Tasmania and a number in North America and Canada.
Wow.
So it's quite cool turning people on to a brand I've not heard of before.
Yeah.
And again, maybe a bit of rebellion against my old corporate links when I worked for the big companies. I love an underdog dram. Maybe someone I haven't heard before. It's great value. There's a real story behind it. That's the whiskies I get excited about putting in a lineup for people, and I think the response has been good to that as well, you know.
Yeah, I would imagine some of those are from very small distilleries that aren't even available outside of the Highlands, maybe, or outside of Scotland, or outside the UK.
Yeah, in some cases, I mean, if I can kind of jump in and put one to life, and it's pretty much a constant in the tastings that I would put a bottle on from Dornick Distillery, one of the smallest distilleries in Scotland. It's run by Phil and Simon Thompson, and they jointly own the Dornick Castle Hotel. That's in the square, looks out onto the cathedral. They are actually building a new distillery at the moment, so they're really jumping up a few paces. They do their own whiskey. They also do what we call independent bottlings. So that's where they might buy a cask from somebody like Tomatin or Glenmurray. They'll do their own version of it. So probably higher ABV, higher strength, limited edition, super quirky labels. So again, family-owned, a craft-style distillery, if you like. And I'd just like to—I like obviously mention it along with Dornick Golf Club, where you've got one of the oldest and, dare I say, most traditional golf courses, and within a quarter of a mile, you've got the super—I'll call them quirky, almost disruptors of the whiskey world—the Young Thompson guys.
What do they do?
Well, I mean, the way they again, in terms of their distillation. I think they've been described in one of the main books on whiskey recently as being one of the most inefficient distilleries in Scotland. But they feed into that. So it's not about super slick production, putting millions of units out the door. It's older style, working with some older strains of barley, longer maturation times. It's almost like having a made-to-measure suit, Frank, as opposed to one mass production where we're doing 5,000 suits a day.
Yeah, I love this one.
So more bespoke, but family business, and as I say, they're doing something very small, very niche, within quarter of a mile of, the amazing Dornick Championship course, which, I think as we sit here in the April 2026, I think all the visitor times are booked up for Dornick already this year. So we're working at a huge scale with an amazing clubhouse. It's almost a juxtaposition between the two within quarter of a mile of each other in Dornick.
I heard they just put up a statue of Donald Ross and some guy that was the secretary, I think the first secretary of Dornoch that they just unveiled. They're doing some good stuff up there. Let me ask you this. Maybe some do's and don'ts when it comes to drinking whiskey. Do you have a favorite whiskey cocktail? Or is there something that you don't do? You personally.
No, I mean, especially like I say, in a warm night. We occasionally get warm nights in Scotland, Frank, at least two a year. I love an old fashioned. I'm not a big whiskey cocktail man, but I would say for newcomers to whiskey, because it is a strong taste and it's quite, can be quite punchy. I think whiskey cocktails are a far better entry point for non-whiskey drinkers than, say, a Jack Daniels and Coke. So I'm all for whiskey cocktails done imaginatively, served with a bit of pizzazz. Then yeah, I would never look down in any way at a whiskey cocktail, and it can be quite refreshing on a warmer day where maybe a full dram's not quite what you're looking for, you know.
An old fashioned always works.
Yeah.
What about putting drops of water into the whiskey when you drink it neat? Is that a it's I kind of imagine it's like eating sushi, you know? I mean the Japanese guys, they know exactly when to put the wasabi. We just put it in the soy sauce and have at it. Do we put water or no? And if yes, how much?
Yeah, for me, Frank, definitely. So again, one of my little gags with the golfers is on the cat on the when caddying, I'm trying to keep them away from the water. But when we're doing the whiskies, I'm trying to encourage the water. So I mentioned before my son who's now found his way over to staying in Mainz in Germany. Ironically, my worst subject in school, Frank, was science, and he's got a PhD in chemistry.
Well, there you go.
Okay. So he would come on and tell you quite succinctly about the different density, if you like, of whiskey to water, and how dropping some water into the into a whiskey will actually release some of the fatty acids and the complex flavors and bring them to the surface. So again, in interacting and hearing different opinions and styles, I appreciate a lot of boys and girls from America, their style of drinking whiskey is a shot style. So I absolutely take them away from that. You know, if the whiskey's been in the cask for 15 years, let's not then destroy it in 15 seconds.
Well, the American
So I do
market.
say to him, look, we're in the Highlands of Scotland. The pace is slower here. We're slowing down. We've got an hour to enjoy the whiskey. We don't have to put them down in five shots. And absolutely, some people have the culture. And again, you look at the movies, you look at things like Netflix, where they're all sorry, Suits on Netflix, when they're all drinking whiskey in the bar and drinking it down in a oneer. The other kind of point I make is that if you're not adding water to whiskey, you're technically not getting all the flavors from it. So while some people, Frank, think us Scots are mean with money, we're not mean with money. We just like value for money. To get the full flavour, I sometimes put the visitors that they're paying, you know, £300 for a round of golf. If they're not putting adding water to the whiskey, it's like paying for 18 holes but only getting 14. Sometimes they'll go with me, but it's their whiskey; they can drink it as they wish. But for some of the getting some of the flavours, I would always add some drops of water just to find your sweet spot.
So we're just talking about a couple of drops.
I'll always say you can put water in but can't take it out. So I'd keep encourage people keep on putting the water in until you find your sweet spot. So there's no judgment. If you need to go, you know, half as much again, it's however you enjoy it. It's not a competition about trying to grin and bear it and drink it down if you're not comfortable with it, you know.
I think that's really important because, you know, as soon as you hear the word sommelier when it comes to wine, or now you can even become a coffee sommelier in like a weekend, it's really about what you like, not what somebody else
Absolutely.
thinks you should like. So, but never on ice, never on the rocks.
Not for me. Again, part of the whole experience about whiskey is also smelling it as well as tasting it. So if you walk around the Lynx Golf Course at the moment in Scotland in April time, you'll see the gorse out. Beautiful yellow flower, smells like coconut up front. So that's part of the whole, and again, you go and play with the seaside, you'll get the sea salt smell and the seaweed. So part of the whole enjoyment is about smell, and if you put ice in the whiskey, it actually dampens down the smell. So you don't get the full aroma if there's an ice cube in it. So no ice for me.
All right. Maybe a total beginner's question. Can you just briefly, in like you're talking, like Jeremy Irons said in Margin Call, like you're talking to a Labrador, explain the difference between a single malt and blended whiskey.
Yeah, so single malt is all whiskey from one distillery. So they might have used more than one cask in that malt. The age of it is all got the youngest whiskey that's in there. So they might have used 10-year-old whiskey, might have used 12 or 15 for more depth, but it's got to be the lowest age. That's what goes on the label. Blended whiskey, especially blended malt, is just single malt whiskey from different distilleries. I guess now where we sit, Frank, in 2026, yeah, malts are really get the attention. That's where all the visibility's been in maybe the last 20 odd years. I always have a little bit of challenge with somebody who say I don't drink blends, because I think to not drink and embrace blends is really ignoring I mean some great whiskies. And it's almost diminishing where blends have been a real bedrock of Scotch whisky over many decades. My little tease again with some of the American visitors is when they talk about blends, and it's almost like putting together an all-star team in the NBA. You're pulling out great whiskies from different distilleries, making it into something a one team. Of course, then we go and talk about Ryder Cup, which is obviously a good conversation for the Europeans to have more than our American friends, where maybe their blending hasn't been great in
Hopefully it'll
recent
stay
years,
that
but
way.
you
Hopefully it'll stay that way. I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you what your favorite Scottish whiskey is. But what would be your one of your favorites or your top three non-Scottish whiskies.
Top three non-Scottish whiskies.
Or one or two of them is.
Okay, so some people might find this surprising, but there is some excellent English whiskey.
Huh. Well, they make whiskey all over the world now. We make whiskey here in Germany. They make whiskey in Japan for I don't know how long.
Oh yeah, that's well established. So yeah, you have put me in the spot a little bit there. Great English whiskey that I tried, I think for the first time this year, was Wireworks, which is based in Derbyshire, about the kind of Midlands of England, and they do a really great little lightly peated
I'm going to write
whiskey.
that down.
Yeah, definitely Wireworks is excellent. Another one that went down really well, I did some tastings when the rugby was on, the Six Nations rugby. So we kind of do that as a blind tasting with different countries, but you have to rank them, then guess what they are. Was sherried version of Redbreast whiskey from Ireland. Beautiful whiskey. People, Scots guys, were voting it favourite out of that little group we had. Lots of Americans choose from North America. I'll probably go with Westland, which are from northwest up in Seattle. So it's not bourbon, it is, it's obviously American whiskey. Very Scottish in style.
What's it called?
Westland, all one word.
Westland.
And they do peated and unpeated.
Well, yeah, because I was going to ask you about bourbon, but that's not your cup of tea, your cup of
I've
whiskey.
probably got about eight bottles of bourbon. I think I enjoy having it. It's definitely got it's I mean a rich history of bourbon, and the links between the bourbon barrels and Scotland are not to be underestimated. I like to have some bourbons and keep myself up to date with that scene, Frank. Obviously, for North American clients coming over, it's good just to be able to say, yeah, I've dipped into your world as well before we now spend a lot of time in Scottish. But no, some great world whiskies. You can't be too parochial about it. There's some great stuff out there.
And then you, of course, you have, the single malts, you have the 12-year-old, the 16-year-old, the 24-year-old. And with age, the price rises. Is an older whiskey always a better whiskey?
No. So kind of looking back, that first summer when I was out in my finance career, I did work in one of the whisky shops in Inverness. It is what it is. I think in any retail environment, Frank, you're looking to keep the till ticking over. So there's always that pressure to be bidding the client up to the top shelf, if you know what I mean. Again, I just like value for money. So again, some people will want to buy a premium whisky because it's been on Netflix or in the James Bond movies or whatever it may be. If somebody come in, you obviously ask what your budget is, so you're keeping them, at a level they're comfortable spending. Lots of things can influence the price. Rarity, absolutely. The dynamics behind the distillery, they're just up and coming. Have they got a brand to lean into that they've successfully premiumized? Older's not ever better. Again, we talked about peated whiskey before, which some of the viewers may not appreciate. If you like that peat punch, the whiskey actually kind of loses that over time. So the peats are its most effervescent between maybe 5, 10, 12 years. So if that's the style you like, and I've dealt with some German visitors before, that's what they love, that real intense charcoal bonfire taste. If you were to buy a 24-year-old peated whiskey, it's a much more mellowed out affair. On the contrary, with sherry-based whiskey, in the main, that's going to get more pronounced, deeper taste as it goes on. But again, I'm not an expert on sherry, but I do appreciate there's about 9 or 10 different varieties of sherry that are made in the Jerez area of Spain.
So when you're talking about
One of
sherry,
my favourite is.
you're talking about the casks.
So that's where the whiskey will be seasoned or matured in the casks. If I think about technically the nearest distillery to where I am here, Royal Brackley Distillery, they have a 12-year-old, which is finished in Oloroso sherry, which is probably the most popular type they use in Scotch. Very sweet. The 18-year-old Royal Brackley is matured in Paolo Curtado sherry. Not as overtly sweet, a bit more dialed back, a bit more of a slower burn. If you just love that super sweet taste, maybe the 12-year-old is more to your preference than the 18, which is a bit more of a subtle affair, shall we say. So, yeah.
I mean, you read now, how people invest in whiskey just for the sake of making money. I find that fascinating. But coming back to the peat, and when you talk about sustainability, I read an article, the only article I really read in preparation for this, that there are now different methods to bring the peatiness into a or peatness, peatiness, kind of, I don't know, into the whiskey, not by actually digging it up or but just by the smoke. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, I think there is certainly a movement towards that, Frank. I mean, I think the last time I saw a percentage, the amount of peat around the globe that's kind of involved in the whiskey world, if you like, is about 1%. So it's relatively small, but I appreciate, distilleries have to be cognizant of the world and the way things are. So I can't really say I've come across a distillery really kind of overtly saying, well, this is the way we make it now. I do know one chap who's actually a fellow German who likes to collect whiskey, and I think his mindset at the moment is he's going to maybe invest in some peated whiskey because that might be more of a rarity now than it is somewhere down the line. We shall watch that space.
There you go.
Yeah,
There's
it's
some
that anything.
hope.
People will find a way. Clever people will find a way around the new world order, won't they?
Yeah.
So if we can't simply extract peat the way we're making it before, there'll be other ways to infuse whiskey with that smoky, kind of texture.
Yeah. And one of the, it's not really a dichotomy, but it's just, I found it fascinating. I mean, outside of Scotland, most people enjoy golf when it's sunny and warm, and the weather is nice. In Scotland, no wind, no rain, no golf. What kind of whiskey would be a good whiskey for a warm summer day?
Warm summer day. I would maybe put two hip flasks in my golf bag for a warm summer day. Might kick off with a Tomatin Legacy or Tomatin 12-year-old. More lightly sherry, more bourbon kind of element to it. So maybe that might be my dram for the opening nine, and then coming home, and maybe a Glen Scotia 15-year-old, which are down in Campbellton.
So lighter whiskies. I mean, would be lighter be the word, or mellower,
Yeah, I
or?
would say so. I would say so. I mean, there is a bit of I mean, I've drunk peated whisky and all weather types, Frank, inside and outside. But I think for most people, they'd probably prefer a peated whisky in a more an autumn evening with a big fire on. That's probably
Right.
more ambient for them, if you know what I mean. But for someone like, I would say, one of the Tomatins or maybe a Glen Scotia, that to me would feel like an outside summer day whiskey.
Right. And the cold, windy, rainy day whiskey.
In the dreich conditions, we'd call it. Thinking again along my golfing drams, then I could maybe think about a King's Barnes whiskey from St Andrews, one of the newer distilleries this century.
Is that the one that they made last year that sold out in like a matter of, I don't know what?
Yeah, they've done a few limited editions, so I think the one that probably went really quickly last year, and I'll give him a shout out, fellow caddy Doug Clement, who does some caddying at King's Barnes. Doug was actually the founder, if you like, of King's Barnes Distillery. And is still involved with it, doing private tastings. So from King's Barnes, I think the peated version is called Coal Town, if I've got that right. So younger whiskey, more of a bourbon kind of element to it, so quite fresh. And in the homeward nine for a peated whiskey, I'd maybe actually look back with Tomatin again. They've got a 15-year-old fully matured in sherry casks. So great warming whiskey, and I mean, dare I say, if you weren't a peat fan, that Oloroso cask 15-year-old from Tomatin it's almost got a bit of sweetness that might offset some of the peaty flavor. So it could almost be a little gateway for somebody to take their first steps into the peated whiskey range.
I can imagine your American customers are also cigar smokers, some of them.
Yeah, they can sometimes go down with a little cloud. Good. I love the smell of cigars. I'm not a smoker in any shape or form, but I love the smell of it.
Good cigars smell
And
good.
sorry.
Good cigars smell good.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Yes.
I mean,
So
that's what
I don't mind being downwind of them when they've got the cigars out. Yeah.
yeah, there you go. From what I know, the whiskey first and then the cigar. This is what I was told is the right order because the alcohol takes away the saliva and makes the warm mouth the mouth warm, and then the cigar cools it and brings the saliva back. That's what a very
That would make
clever.
sense to me. I have actually seen things on YouTube where people are pairing whiskies to cigars and having them almost simultaneously. But yeah, again, would you call a cigar? It's an indulgence, isn't it? It's not a quick kind of
Exactly.
fix, quick hit. It's something you're going to enjoy over a period of time, adding to the whole experience of it. So I do get the mindset of a cigar smoker. I think could sit quite well with a whiskey drinker who's looking to take their time over it. We're not just popping it down in a shot style and leaning into the whole experience, you know.
I think that's what it's all about, and also in golf, it's about taking the time and not racing around the course in record time and shooting 130. The same with the whiskey or 1,000. Same with the whiskey and the cigars. Quickly, and maybe we have time to go back to your business model. The tour operators. Would those people be your competitors, the ones that take people off the golf course and take them on tours, or who you work with the distilleries and with the golf courses together, obviously, simultaneously?
Yeah, I mean, most of my bookings, in fact, and I'm only in year three, so I'm still kind of finding my way. I mean, I'm up for collaborating with anybody. So, to be fair, I probably don't really get any bookings from the distilleries because really they want people coming to do their brand-led experience.
But they also want you to present their whiskies at the tastings you do, no?
I've had great reaction. Again, that's part of my joy now, Frank. I decide what whiskies go in the lineup. So I've had some great interaction from distilleries when they've seen the whiskey in the lineup being enjoyed by people all around the world. Tour operators, you say, they're absolutely people I'm getting closer to. I was down at the Scottish Golf Tourism Week in Edinburgh just last month. So all I'm trying to do is explain that I'm an option. So I'm not a night in the pub. Obviously, some distilleries are very easy to get to. Some require a little bit more logistics to go to. And some of the golfing visitors, Frank, they come out year after year to the Highlands of Scotland, which is brilliant. So they've maybe done a number of distillery tours. And while all the distilleries will have a different version out this year or different bottling out, maybe they've seen the tour. You know, I mean, when you go around, if you're going for the whole tour, I mean, the first 40 minutes probably is looking at some machinery and some grain, which is really interesting.
Yeah, the
For some
bottling
people, once
plant.
I've done that three or four times, I've kind of seen that, man. I know how that works. So the tour operators, I'm just trying to make myself, I'm on the radar, guys. I'm here. I can jump in at pretty short notice. And again, if somebody wants a tasting at 9 o'clock in Dornoch, I can do that. As opposed to opening times where you've got to be in. And some of the tastings will only be on once a day or twice a day. So hopefully flexibility, open mind, authentic kind of storytelling, if you like. And we're not just dialing into one particular distillery. We're telling five different stories about how they all link together with the game of golf, you know.
Right. You ever go after you've finished the five drams in an hour and a half or whatever it is, any late night putting competitions on the putting green?
Not while I've been there. Not while I've been there. Not to say it's not happened. I might have to
I'm
plead the
sure
fifth on
it
that one, Frank. I played the fifth dram. I didn't say anything, okay?
has. Hey, well, you're the host, so but I think what you just said is a perfect example of the Scottish hospitality. You'll take anybody on this journey.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely fascinating. The glass. I want to ask you about the glasses. Because with the wine, they're, oh, you drink the white wine out of this and the red wine out of this. Is the glass important when it comes to enjoying these whiskies?
I would say it is. So the style of glass, I'm sure it'll be familiar. I think it's on my logo. It's called the Glencairn glass. So tulip shaped, we call it. So narrow at the top. If again we feed into what I said before, Frank, about part of the enjoyment is the smell and the aroma. So rather than just diving straight in and gulping it down, the narrow shape at the top of the glass helps almost funnel the smell towards one's nostrils. A tumbler much wider at the top and more attuned to a bit of ice into, the smell's going to evaporate because the top of the glass is too wide, if you know what I mean. Again, there's no right way, there's no wrong way to drink it, Frank. I'm just trying to,
Yes,
again, like my Sherpa thing,
I absolutely
to get the most out of these. That's the style of the glass that will give you the most aroma as well as the taste, you know.
I love that because, like I said earlier, people are intimidated by these so-called experts, and to have somebody like you come on and say, just do what you in, what you like the best, what work whatever works for you.
It's kind of like playing, within reason. Once you're on the golf course, I mean, you can play how you want. You can take irons off the tee. Obviously, you need to keep up a pace of play. You can do your own thing. It's, yeah. Well, there's too many things in life to get serious about. Whiskey's not really one of them. And again, in terms of the whole science behind it and how it's made, what the casks are made of, yeah, if people want to chat about that, then great. It's not really what they're there for, to be honest with you. It's about
Absolutely.
getting the whiskies going, getting the stories going,
It's the
and
experience.
chatting about the provenance of where they're from, you know.
And it's also an experience, I think, that's very important for the game of golf, and it's getting lost in today's world a little bit because people are too busy and they don't have time. But when I take my 11-year-old daughter to the golf course for her lesson, and I make sure every time she finishes, we sit down at the bar in the clubhouse and have a Coke and just talk about golf or whatever, I mean, and that's getting lost a little bit. So I'm glad we had the opportunity to talk about that. It's dramcaddy.com, ladies and gentlemen. Last question, Hamish. And when you see Neil Hampton next week, you can compare answers. You win the club championship. You go celebrate in a karaoke bar. What's your go-to song?
If I was going to the karaoke bar, Frank, that would signify it's time to clear the bar. I would think, have I think I have done karaoke in the past, but it may have been after a night of refreshments. Trying to think of some of the golfing theme here. I'm sure there's been some golfing things. I tell you, kind of touching what we said already in terms of just the freedom to enjoy whiskey how you like, play golf how you like, and I suppose now I'm f finished my finance career, having to toe the party line. We'll go with Frank Sinatra my way.
There you go. Now that's a call, good call right there.
That'll close the bar down. That'll
My
shut the
way.
bar down there and
It's
then.
all about doing it your way. Hamish, thank you very much for stopping by the program.
A pleasure.
Listen, once again, dramcaddy.com. Everything's there, and you can book Hamish on your next trip to Scotland. We would recommend you organize your own trip and fill in Hamish somewhere along the way. And that's, in our opinion, the best way to enjoy Scotland and the golf. They're not that there's anything wrong with the tour operators, but that's what we prefer. Hamish, sir, thank you very much. Best regards to Scotland, and keep us up to date what's going on with you and the Dram Caddy, please.
Frank Slangeva.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, that was it. To the Links Land.